Hi, I'm Scott.
And I am Zach.
Welcome to Learning Grounds.
Episode 2. Today we sat down with Anisha, who is in the Educational Policy and Management Program here at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
That's EPM, for those in the know.
Ooh, in the know.
Mm-hmm.
We had a conversation that started with school choice and charter schools and how policy could improve that whole mess, as you might say. And then we talked about cultural competency and how schools might be able to work that into their curricula.
If you have a cup of coffee or some time,
or both, really,
you are invited to sit down with us and listen in on what Anisha is learning this week.
Welcome back. I know you missed us.
Yeah.
So to get started out for this episode, I should say that the coffee is from, not to try and get any kind of corporate sponsors.
The coffee is from corporate sponsors.
It is from an establishment named after a very popular Battlestar Galactica character.
Oh, man. I can't believe you just said
that. Did I go too nerdy?
Oh, that's so nerdy.
The original reference is nerdy enough.
Is it nerdier? Is it nerdier that I said that the establishment was named after the character? Because in my brain,
right,
they really liked Battlestar Galactica. And they were like, that's what I want to name my coffee shop
right
after.
What?
That was in your mind.
Though. That's
what
in just in my brain.
About?
Never mind.
too nerdy. Even our guest doesn't know the reference.
Unless I'm totally off, I could have sworn it was a Moby Dick reference.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. That's what I was like.
I hated Moby Dick.
When was the first time you read Moby Dick, though?
Ninth grade English. It was in ninth grade English, but I was in eighth grade.
I think I read it in like seventh.
Not to be
grade.
Off.
It was Martin, too early.
Though,
yeah, it was
I read
bad.
It when younger.
It was
sorry.
Bad.
And you hated it?
I hated it because it was super long.
I wanted everybody to die.
I was
Queequeg,
too young to beat it.
Ishmael. Everybody.
He was like, call me Ishmael. I was like, I'm gonna call you.
Just die.
Yeah.
Why am I
just
calling?
Just get eaten by a whale. And how do you get on that ship? Anyway,
our guest this week is
Anisha.
Hi, Anisha.
Hi,
I'm
guys.
Zach.
Welcome. I'm Scott.
Anisha, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a chai tea latte from a reference to a Battlestar Galactica and Moby Dick.
And Moby Dick.
Mainly Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
I totally think Moby Dick trumps Battlestar Galactica.
You would think that if,
in history,
our audience is.
Well, also, a whale can't travel through space.
True.
So Galactica would totally not even have to fire a shot and the whale would die. Just to follow that logic.
It's a space whale. Space whale.
Okay, well, space is. That's what Melville was getting at, but
yes.
He never had the courage to put on the page.
Well, it was a genre piece that he was writing.
It's true literary form. It's not working. But if I go sci-fi,
right.
H.G. Wells seems to be doing all right. Scott, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a decaf Americano. Shots of hazelnut. Two shots of hazelnut.
Yeah, it is not what Scott ordered, but Battlestar Galactica coffee shop was out of decaf coffee. And I was like, there's one thing you shouldn't be out of ever, and that's coffee. Of any kind.
As a coffee place.
Right. I am drinking their new blonde roast, which is their light roast, but they usually burn their beans anyway, so it's like what any other coffee shop would call their medium roast.
Excellent.
But this particular place just likes to burn their beans.
It
anyway,
sexier though, blonde. Room.
Blonde, I know. I'd like a grande blonde, please.
Yes,
it just sounds strange.
Can we all want
by the way, by the way, you just outed yourself as a coffee snob.
I am.
You know what I mean?
I said Battlestar Galactica, so I think.
Well, you've outed yourself at a variety of ways.
You're just out of the closet.
The
closet is broken.
Whatever closet there is, I'm probably in there somewhere looking for a sweater.
Right.
This is Learning Grounds. This is Learning Grounds, episode 2. Anisha, what are you learning?
What am I learning? Right now, and at least in my current classes, I don't know if I can say throughout Hugsy what I've learned, but a lot about policy memos, a lot that government officials are really, really complicated people. Politics slows down life. And,
Did you not know that before?
I did, but not within the context of education, and very vaguely. You know, you kind of hear red tape bureaucracy, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That's kind of like the...
You watch C-SPAN.
Right, the shtick of government. But then you realize, like, no, Like, we are actually working against ourselves in some ways.
So, you are in what program?
I'm in Ed Policy and Management.
Zach's also in Ed Policy.
But only because it makes me able to take whatever classes I want. Not because I'm necessarily, woo, this is great.
It's the popular because it is the least prescribed.
Exactly. Yeah. What does that tell us about education?
What is the fact that Ed Policy is, like, the least prescribed?
No, that people flock. It is the most popular.
because there's people no requirement.
This is easier.
I have choice in that program. I'll do that. And then I'll start a school where no one has any choice.
Mm. It's so funny you bring that up, because I was just, I have class with Paul Revel. Mm-hmm.
Secretary of Education
for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, as he likes to say the whole damn
the
title.
Commonwealth. God,
which is fine.
As a person from California, that just slightly enrages me that anybody would actually call themselves a. I mean, I understand that Massachusetts is a Commonwealth, but I don't want to hear
there are four about Commonwealths.
There are four of them. Can you name them? I cannot. You just geographical. You're
not a snob.
No.
You're just knowledgeable.
I'm sorry, I know things.
Right.
Getting hated on.
I'm taking a class with Paul Revel, and our whole big thing for this week was choice schools, charter schools, the whole choice movement. Mm-hmm. Ultimately it comes down to statement earlier. Is just like you don't really have a choice. Like, these are the limited spans of choices. When you get into the school that's your choice school, you don't really have a choice over what they're teaching. You don't have a choice of who's in the classroom. It feels like you do because you lotteried in or you took your kid out or whatever it might be. But, you know, this idea of false choice within education is, and maybe that's what we're doing. We're kidding ourselves in EPM to be like, we have a choice. And it's like, no.
Could you go over just a little bit a slightly more fleshed out definition of what a choice school or a charter school in the context that you're studying, what that means?
Okay. I might not do it justice, but I will try. As I understand it, have you done the readings?
Yes.
Okay. He can't say no. He's being recorded.
But he asked you. So I'll let you take this one.
Well, I'll go through this a mini version of Diane Ravitch's summary of it as I followed it thus far. So choice kind of was born out of vouchers and this idea that I think some sense of competition, so that, you know, we need to make public education better, but we're not serving well these kids that are here, so we should give them vouchers to move towards kind of a privatization of education. So if people can go, the government will pay for students to go to schools they'd rather not go to in lieu of their public school, their neighborhood public school. And as that kind of got a lot of political pushback because people were anti the privatization of government or privatization of education, and some people were pro the privatization of education, a little back and forth. And so from vouchers flowed charter schools, which are schools basically that someone can go to an authorizing entity and say, I want to start the school, this is what I want to do with it, this is the population I want to serve, and they get authorized for 3 to 5 years, and they could open in most places or any place right now in the country, and then they bring their kids in, and so that's an optional choice for students in lieu of the traditional public school. Other choice schools? I know there are other ones, but I don't know how to fully.
Well, there are magnet schools, which operate more within the traditional framework, but oftentimes have a theme or something that they around them. I used to teach at two different magnet schools, not at the same time. And so oftentimes those can be special select or special admit schools. So it's not the same kind of lottery system. But it's kind of most popular, I think, is probably kind of a performing arts magnet school.
Right. I think one of the things that I have found interesting, and I, just as a CSO lackey, I will plug Recruiting Intensive this week and into next. One of the things that I've noted recently as a CSO employee is that there are so many charter schools and choice schools that I was unaware of that exist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For any conceivable, I mean, performing arts is one of the more popular, but for any conceivable, like, thing that somebody could think is important as a method or a lens through which to view education, a charter school exists for that. And there are so many interesting opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're looking for a teaching position, as a CSO person, there are many opportunities.
CSO,
there.
Of course, career yeah. services.
Career service office.
Yeah.
Yes.
No.
However,
Scott yeah. loves the acronym.
Well, I do love
the initials. I guess those are initials.
Right.
They tend to overlap sometimes.
Initialisms.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's just
abbreviation? Is that it's not an
acronym? Is pronounceable.
Acronym.
Yeah.
Pronounceable. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. Pronounceable. Yeah. That's a word.
So we can just call it the. Kazo.
So.
No, career services office.
So. Kazo.
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 Yeah, that's more confusing.
Right.
Well, you could be like, Kazo, what are you going to do with
no.
that? Oh.
What's nice is now.
I am using that next time I'm at the front desk.
Any joke I make from here on out
right.
is going to be a little better than that one. So I feel fine.
Yeah.
So in the reading.
Yeah.
What are you getting? Like, what are you finding your mind changing, or is it more just an information gathering thing at this point?
I mean, I kind of unfortunately have my mind made up about charters. I think they're good. I think they are trying to do a lot. You know, much you said, they're serving, you know, for any fathomable thing you think a population would need, there's a charter. But we have to face reality that there are only 2% of the American children are mm-hmm. in a charter school. So mm-hmm. how big is the dent that they're actually making, right, as far as in improving education for underserved students within any sector, disabled, ELL, low income, minority, etc. And so, but at the same time, I feel like the perception of charters or the way that charters are perceived within the field of education is so clouded. Like, the, you know, they're seen as the panacea, like they're gonna fix everything and we need to reinvest in charters, we need to grow our charters, this is what is gonna change and improve American education. And for me, I just don't believe that.
Well, and I think one of the things that's interesting is the tide is kind of turning in as far as public opinion goes, as far as the place of charters, right? I think a lot of people who maybe got swept up in that movement of this will fix everything, which wasn't everybody who was making the pro-charter case, but I think a lot of people got moved around in that, and I think they're coming to the point of, oh, wait, maybe we need to be a little bit more thoughtful. Just more doesn't equal better in
right.
this particular instance.
Exactly.
And one of the things that's troubling with me is the closing of charters, right? Mm-hmm. So, the part, and this seems to me the strangest thing, because I get up on my soapbox. So charters were open with the understanding that we'll let you try this out, mm-hmm. and if it shows merit, if you show student learning mm-hmm. through test scores, because that's how you know kids are learning.
That was the sound effect for Zach is being sarcastic.
I'm being a little snarky. No, but that if you show that students are learning based on these outputs, you will keep your charter and you'll be able to keep doing your thing.
Mm-hmm. And there are charters generally expand the student body in that case.
Right. Yeah. But there are charter schools that aren't doing that.
Right.
And so they're getting they're not getting closed, and that's I think the bigger issue, right? Because then you're closing a kid's school, right? It's not, oh, this wasn't such a great idea, let's not do it anymore. Right. You're closing children's schools, mm-hmm. and oftentimes you're doing it to populations that have so very little stability in the first place, mm-hmm. and you're saying we're going to close this down. And I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and he was saying, and it's also saying all that work you did over the last 3 years of your life,
it's irrelevant.
It doesn't count anymore. And it's this kind of adults were thinking about adults in a way and not about kids. So from one side, I'm like, yeah, we should close down schools that aren't doing...
Right. But
like, this is
time,
what we said we'd do.
Right.
But we're also playing with kids in this particular, and their lives, and their whatever belief they may still have had in adults.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of trashing it in a way.
Did you read the part of the Ravage chapter where she was talking about like some charter school, I don't know what they're called, like the people who were running the charter schools, they basically were just taking money,
right?
The buildings were like non-furnished,
yeah,
the kids were barely coming to school, and
yeah,
they were just kind of taking government money. And I think this stories like that make me feel like, okay, I'm so pro government involvement in everything,
right?
Because I feel like what other body could exist that should regulate and mandate what should be happening in this school?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, crap happens in public schools, but I feel like that type of stuff you can't get away with that type of stuff.
Right.
For exceedingly long periods of time in a public school, in a government-sponsored public school.
Right.
That is not
a traditional public school.
And again, like the instability and the potential short-lived life of charters freaks me out.
Yeah.
For the same reason, you know, if you're not successful within the 3 to 5 years that you have, then we're just moving on to the next thing. And I think that's true in education reform in general. You know, things don't have time to vegetate.
There's not a level of patience there.
No.
Yeah, no. For the ideas to really take root. And so I wonder, do you think that means that the ideas themselves, because you know you don't have long to make your case, that the ideas themselves are rushed? Mm-hmm. Not even like, oh, we didn't get a chance to grow this, but we didn't really think it out before we did it.
Right.
Do you think that?
I think that could get back to my previous point about, like, the craziness that is government, right? Because I feel like it's a lot of people from government being like, we need to see this change right now.
Mm-hmm.
And even Arne Duncan, when he was here, he was talking about, I feel an urgency. Mm-hmm. And it was like, great, you feel an urgency, but these things can't be accomplished in a year or 3 years or 5 years or even 10 years, and there's not a willingness to be patient,
right?
You know, because we have to think about election cycles, and we have to think about all these things that are coming up, whether it's from the mayor's election cycle to state Congress to
a million different
actors. Yeah, so everyone's throwing their hat in, and you know, they want to see something done in their term so it makes them look good. And much like you said, it's adults looking out for adults on themselves and not really worrying about what's going to happen to this child if I win or if I don't win re-election.
Right.
They can't see beyond their own personal mission to see the long-term mission of, like, educating children.
Well, I think one of the interesting things here is, I mean, what you're talking about is a rhetorical stance, adults caring about adults.
Mm-hmm.
And very often, particularly now, I think, when it comes to education policy, there's this, the buzzword, at least in the reading that I've done, which is admittedly significantly less than you guys based on your program, is change. We want to see change. We want to do this, we want to
right.
do that. And it's not just we want to see one thing changed. It's that we want to see the system revolutionized.
Overhauled
completely.
Right.
And I think that a culture at any specific point in time has a pretty narrow vision about what really overhauling, revolutionizing any system probably entails, in that very often revolutions are series of changes over time rather than one big massive change that'll cure everything. You know what I'm saying? You know, as though it were.
But don't you have to sell it that way? I mean, it kind
that's
of
the question.
To your
that's
point.
The question.
Like, don't
in
you
terms
have to
politics.
Sell it as one big massive change?
Right.
Because if you say, there's this thing I want to do, it's going to take about 50 years.
Right.
We'll probably mostly be dead.
Right.
When it gets done.
For me, that's the idea of mission, right? Like, it's not about you. It's not about you
right.
being able
right.
to live it out and to say, I did this. It's about the ultimate change. Like, we need to fix this thing.
Right. I mean, are we looking long-term at the education of children? Are we talking even about our own kids?
Mm-hmm.
Just saying, like, if I had a child, you know, I want to see my child educated this way.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I'm going to make this happen for this brief, I mean, and the education of one child, while excruciatingly important, is, let's be honest, in the general scheme of things, a fairly brief period of time. Because 100 years is a fairly brief period of time in the massive scheme of history.
Getting really existential here.
I mean, and so right now, a lot, and we are I mean, it is political rhetoric and how you need to sell it. And we're talking, Arne Duncan was here, and there are other politicians who've tried to advance ideas and platforms based on caring about the children, and of course they do care about the children and they want these positive things to happen, but caring about the children is a buzzword, and who are those children? I mean, when we talk about caring about the children, adults think about children en masse,
mm-hmm.
as this like behemoth thing that we can just mold or shape or whatever, and that's our driving force, and that's fair enough, but there are always going to be kids. We're never gonna.
Fingers crossed.
I hope there's always gonna be kids.
And
kids are changing every moment. As more of them come into the world, more of them become more mature as they grow. And I guess my question is, to wrap up my.
Is there a question?
I do.
I was surprised. I was like, there's a leading
yeah,
to a question.
There is. It is leading to a question. I rarely do, but sometimes I do. So I was. I'm bringing in another reading. There's a woman whose name I cannot pronounce because I'm illiterate. Pina Chodron, I believe, is what her name is. P-E-M or maybe N-A-C-H-O-D-R-O-N. And she has written a series of books. She's a Buddhist nun. And she wrote a book called When Things Fall Apart. And in this book, on about page 8, I believe,
wow.
She talks about the cycle. I'm reading this now.
So much for that illiteracy.
I know.
I think it's fake.
I'm illiterate and have a photographic memory.
She writes about the perpetual cycle of things building up and things falling apart. Mm-hmm. Things building up and things falling apart. And how that is a natural cycle. Mm-hmm. That things always kind of build and build and build and build, and then they get really messed up. Mm-hmm. Because that's the way human life is. Mm-hmm. And that's the way societies work. We build towards this incredible thing, and then and right now, the political rhetoric is talking about building towards a utopia where we, the United States, once again is the leading country in the world, as opposed to Uruguay or South Korea or whomever. Mm-hmm. You know, like with the rhetoric that politicians have been using is talking about the fact that there are other countries that are more advanced than we are technologically, chiefly, mm-hmm. When they use this rhetoric. And in the utopian world, which maybe used to exist, we are number one. America's number one, because we always think we are. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question is, how does it change the framework of our discussion when we imagine that the population that we're trying to affect is not one thing that we can just change and make better, but is instead modulus, and that it is constantly in a cycle of building up, getting better, and then things becoming destroyed for one reason or another, whether or not it's a massive economic change or a war or whatever it may be. In this case, it's sort of a combination of those. But how does it change the frame if we don't think about this as we have to change and improve and make better, and then suddenly everything will be great? Mm-hmm. First of all, because the kids that are kids now are not going to be kids later. And secondly, because you just can't do that. You just have to do the best you possibly can today and tomorrow and the next day, and maybe that makes things better. But at the same time, it's not about, like, we suck now, and we got to be better later, and blah, blah, blah. It's just about doing the best you can every day for every kid you see. Mm-hmm. How does it change really it's political rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And can that be effective from a policy standpoint?
Anisha?
And go!
I mean, no, like, unfortunately.
Simple answer. I love that. I like the way, like, a 3-minute build-up, and then, like, no.
No, it built up, and then it fell apart.
Totally, exactly, mission accomplished. It was human nature.
We are good with illustrations.
Well, no, I think that's what everyone, at least everyone who I'm talking to here now, wants. From what I understand, it is this idea of, you know, kind of reshaping the conversation, reframing the way that we see mm-hmm. education, how we want to educate children in this very long-term, non-selfish, non-generational idea, if I'm correct, if that's what you were going for. I hope most people have that.
Yeah.
But I just don't think it's necessarily, and I'm probably a bit of a pessimist, I don't think it's, you know, possible within our current structure. And to kind of go back against everything you just said, like, we would need a political overhaul. Like, we would have to, our entire system would have to look significantly different. And maybe, you know, and unfortunately, it's weird to say that that has to be the first step before we can change education, but we do have to change the way politics and politicians see the world before we can create policy that they will actually accept. And so maybe it'll take us a century to redo government. Uh-huh. And then when we're done doing that, right. We can readdress all these kind of social issues that haven't been framed the right way, and that we haven't.
So, if that's the case, two-part question, but it's sort of the same question. One, why are we here? And another way to say that is, if the necessity is in government, mm-hmm. why didn't we all decide to go to the Kennedy School rather than here?
I wouldn't say the necessity is all in government. I think you asked for a policy.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm just pushing on it. Yeah. No. Absolutely.
I think there are reasons why. You know, people are here, there are reasons why people are at the Kennedy School, there are reasons why people here are in policy and other people are in tech. Like, you know, we all have our roles to play, as small as they may be, and, mm-hmm. you know, going back to your existentialism, like, yeah, you know, we're all gonna, you know, make this, like, I don't even know, NASA's hole in the universal windshield, but we're not, you know, we have to do our part. Mm-hmm. For as short as we're here, we have to try to do something, and if it's all about incremental change and we choose to not do our share of moving the increment, mm-hmm. then what does it matter, you know? Mm-hmm. But why are people at Hugsy rather than at HKS? Why am I personally at it?
I mean, I guess, so we are having a, you said something about pessimism a little bit ago that I imagine many, many people feel. You know, I think, I mean, I know that I felt it personally. Sometimes I sit there and I go, oh my God, things are so incredibly broken or dysfunctional. And I'm just one person. And I'm not even a person that's in policy. Like, I was an educator. Now I'm, like, into design and neuroscience, you know? And I'm only one person.
It's a natural path.
And so...
it's the next evolutionary step for a teacher.
And so, and I'm only one person, and I get, I feel that pessimism where I'm saying, like, I'm not going to change anything. Because I'm only one person, and what I'm doing... I'm not an Arne Duncan or a politician, and I have no aspirations to be. So I'm not going to be a person that's remembered by history. What is the point of what I am doing if such massive change is not possible? If I won't see it in my lifetime?
Okay.
Skeptical.
Well, first of all, no, and it sounds like what I just said makes it sound like I'm also skeptical and pessimistic. I'm incredibly optimistic.
Right.
And I also don't think that Secretary Duncan has done a whole lot to change the way kids are taught on a daily basis. And I think that that's the, like, you're right. The system is in a shambles, right? From the top down, no one is listening to anyone. But the good work that was going on yesterday in classrooms around the country is going on today and will go on tomorrow.
Right. Except tomorrow's Saturday, so.
No, no. Saturday school.
There it is.
No, but the, my
yes,
point...
Yes, he was publicly educated.
But my point is the same, is that we have bought the deficit model argument that everything is operating in a horrible, horrible way. But it's not. Like, it's just... There are bad things going on, and I do not deny that those... And I've seen them. And there are places that I think are doing wrong by kids.
Right.
But not... I would say all of the places are doing wrong by kids. And even in the places that I think are doing wrong by kids, I don't think there are, every person is doing wrong by kids. And I think that is important to remember. And I think that if all we do is operate on, wow, we have to destroy everything because it is wrong.
Yeah,
because
we suck at everything
that
we're doing.
That deficit thinking is never going to get us anywhere, because then we're all like, and let me try these million things to do to make it right.
I do agree that, like, kind of blaming the government and saying the system is broken is probably a cop-out, right? But I also feel like that's the most visible thing we feel like we can't change.
Right,
because we supposedly exist in a democratic society where the government is a thing we have power over, right?
Right.
And so if we keep looking at the government being like, why won't this move? Why won't this change? We'll be like, well, we have to fix it, because this is a thing we've been taught, for those of us who have had good civic education, that we can move and change the government.
And it operates in this really strange, fallacious kind of assumption of, if I set this policy... then as soon as it's done, then the teachers will know this is the thing they need to change and do differently.
Right.
Right. There's that assumption of, like, if we could just pass this law, then we would improve the teachers.
Everything would be better.
That is why I want to do what I want to do.
What is it you want to do? Getting back to you.
I don't say that. It makes me feel super selfish and be like, well, I thought this was about me.
Wait. Back to me.
We'll cut to the last few minutes.
I want to do, I understand policy needs to be made, and I'm not pro strong government involvement, but I do think the government needs to be involved in policy. I just feel like, what other entity can exist, like I said before, that can kind of mandate and kind of throw out these regulations and make sure that things are happening in some semblance of the way we hope or think they should be happening? I think the government should be kind of, and this is an overstatement, but policing body, just to be like, make sure things are in order and doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Can you, before you move forward with that?
Sure.
Can you, when you say government, like, it can be you mean DEA?
I'm specifically talking about at least the Department of Education within the context of what we're doing. Department of Education. I can't speak to, what, DOJ or whatever, these other entity should be doing, but I feel like the role, I was just talking to someone, I want to write a paper about what the new DOE should look like. It's a small endeavor. I'll get it done by the end of the weekend.
I'll read that.
I'm going to give you 45 minutes, and then you just go.
But basically, I feel like the DOE should have this kind of overarching policing, like, monitoring kind of compliance system type of role in education, and a lot should be left to states. So I feel like the DOE, the federal DOE, should be able to say, okay, these are standards. These are standards we want all of our children to live up to. How you choose to teach them towards these standards, or how you choose to implement a curriculum, is totally up to you, based on your local culture, based on state policy, whatever it might be.
Why does the DOE get to set those standards?
Because I do think there should be a national standard. There should be just something that everyone is shooting towards.
And how do we reach that? How does the DOE craft that?
Craft
in your
that.
Mind?
I mean, I feel like for me it should be probably. I feel like it should be the highest standard. Like I don't.
But how do we get there?
I don't know.
Because I think a lot of people are walking around saying yes, there should be a national standard.
Right, but how do we get there?
And so it's like, okay, who sets it?
I think the DOE should set it. What it should be, how it should be. I haven't gotten that far in my paper yet, but
because I think if you solve that issue, because I think that's what keeps so many people on the outside of this, yeah. Right? Like, there are immense personal and political investments
right.
in what kids are taught in
absolutely
school. I mean, I grew up in Illinois, I taught in Florida, I taught in Philadelphia. Those are three culturally disparate places, and I would say the skills that you need to make it through everyday life, mm-hmm. like everybody needs to read, I'm with you on that, but the way you interpret information for each of those three locations mm-hmm. is so hugely different. And so I kind of wondered, does somebody in Florida need to know how to operate in Philadelphia? In Sarasota, Florida, need to know how to operate in Philadelphia? Is that a skill that is necessary? Are our populations so migratory on the whole that I need to, like, or are states more different than we like to think?
Well, I mean, I feel like from that particular example, I'd take it to, like, this idea of cultural competency, right? And from even going from Florida to... What did you say?
Philadelphia.
Being black in New York and Brooklyn and being black in Manhattan are two very, very different experiences.
Right.
And so I feel like, yes, in some way. Like, I don't know how you would do that, what that curriculum would look like, or what it would be like on a day-to-day, but should a student in Florida know how to function in Philadelphia? Absolutely.
Why?
Because I feel like learning just this one part of culture, one part of who you are, one part of what the country is so limiting. It's so limiting. And I feel like exposure more than anything is a very good education.
Okay, so let's talk about that then. Is it the job of the school to teach that? Like, if I'm in Florida and I need to realize how to function in Philly, is it my school's job to do that? Or will I learn that when I move to Philly? Like, why do I need that thing
right.
if I'm never going to leave my, like, if I'm never going to leave my town of Naples, Florida? Do I need to know
how to operate in Philadelphia?
Right.
I think so. Why? Right.
Yeah.
Why? I don't know. I feel like you close yourself off to so many options, right? To be like, I'm never leaving Naples. Like, why would you never want to leave Naples? Like, there's so much... going back to the existentialism, the world is so freaking big. Like, yeah. Why do you want to just stay in Naples? I've never been to Naples. I'm sure Naples is lovely.
Naples is very lovely.
It sounds like it should be, though, lovely. No. Median age.
A little high.
Okay, so retirement? Is
retirement.
Or if you're into gold digging.
They might call it a golden age community.
You never know.
So...
I don't know how to justify this eloquently, and someone's going to say it for me later, and I'm going to be really upset, but... I just feel like the ability to navigate around areas that aren't your own is mm-hmm. very, very important. Whether that's a neighborhood, whether that's a culture, whether that's a country or a language. Mm-hmm. And maybe we don't need to necessarily be teaching, okay, well, you're in Naples, but this is how stuff works in Philadelphia, as much as we should teach flexibility
and
openness.
And so I wonder if the answer might not be a little bit different in saying, you live here in Naples, from time to time we're going to have people come in who are from another place. Mm-hmm. How can we be more... into and interested in what they're learning, you know, like mm-hmm. rather than here's how you learn wherever you go, mm-hmm. but like say if you stay here, here's how you can be more accepting of the people who come here.
I also think,
you know, like, and
that's fair.
I think I agree that we cannot be completely regionalist in our, you know, how we write curriculum, because the fact remains we are citizens of a nation, one nation, which is the United States.
What's it under?
that I won't speak to. That I won't speak to. But I do think that the one of the responsibilities that education has is to give its citizens a sense of place and civic identity enough to function productively in a democracy. And we have a, so for instance, like, if I was to say to you, and this is something I struggled with coming from California, California, very blue state, generally speaking, and I always have struggled with red state ideas holistically. Like, I have a very difficult time personally as a leftist type person from California, and not being exposed to a huge amount of people who lean right, I have a really hard time, and have always had a really hard time identifying with what it would be like to live in Shreveport, Louisiana, and be in a very...
You don't actually need to leave your state. You could just say Southern California.
I could say Orange, parts of Orange County.
Yeah, like...
But I've always had a really hard time with that, understanding that the idea of living like that and being one of a citizen of my same country, but living in that kind of a region. And I don't think I would function very well.
But is there a way that that can be taught to you?
I think perhaps not, but I think it is a responsibility of my education system to at least inform me that those things and places exist.
Okay.
And that there are ways of thinking that are different than my own, mm-hmm. that may depend on region,
uh-huh.
right, or culture, or, you know, many other things. One of the many, like, issues in a lot of history classes is how in history of our nation we have come from a place of we've always been somewhat divided in certain ways as political parties and in terms of ideology, this and that, and I think it's a really good and positive thing to not teach, like, here's how you talk to a Republican, or here's how you talk to a Democrat, or here's how you talk to a member of whatever party, but rather these things exist, and it is going to be your job to negotiate those things one way or another, because these people are citizens of the same country you are, and they participate in the same democracy that you do.
Yeah, I hear that, and I don't disagree with your point. I don't know that I feel like that's the job of school.
Whose job is it?
Life. I mean, how do you get
life
that from school?
A harsh,
like, how
teacher.
Do you, like, life can be a hard, but it's a teacher, like, and it, well, it's a learning environment, like,
right.
It's.
I don't know. I mean, I see that point. I can see both.
I mean,
points,
like, but... and a kid's not going to care unless they need it, right? There's no, like, oh, thank you for teaching me this thing that I may or may
right,
not ever use.
Right, you have to
use.
Show the relevance of it. And
right, it's like calculus at that point. For me, at least. Other people evidently love calculus and get a lot out of it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. My mind is going in lots of ways, and I'm trying very hard not to philosophize.
That's what this podcast is all about.
I would like to get... I would like to be as grounded and realistic as possible, just because I feel like sometimes we philosophize too much here.
A little bit.
But, yeah, I can't think of anything grounded and realistic that could actually be applied, like, tomorrow.
Right. Well, let's say for... Like, I'll give you, for instance,
mm-hmm.
I grew up in from fifth grade through high school. Went to a very small school district in rural Illinois.
Okay.
And then I moved to Sarasota, Florida.
Okay.
Very different cultures. Things slow down when you cross the border into Florida. In a very, like, relaxed and, like,
beneath the Mason-Dixon.
All of us. No, not even that. Like, Florida is just a little more. We take things as they come. And Brooke just gave us a piece of pizza.
Piece of pizza. Good life.
That's cold and it's been sitting here.
I was actually
Thanks,
there when that pizza came into Gutman. I was there. It's like the red balloon. And that was a long... I'm all about the obscure references today.
It's outstanding.
So I moved to Florida, right? And
okay.
That's a different culture. And
right.
I don't... And I was never... And I worked in it. Like, I fit in,
mm-hmm.
and I learned what I needed to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But there was never any part of my education that said, you're going to someday move to a purple state. Really? depending on where the Supreme Court is.
Right.
But there was, so I learned it, and I don't know, like, if that lesson had been taught in school, I don't know that I would have paid attention to it.
Hmm.
Because I don't know that I had figured out at that point that I was going to leave Illinois. And if it had, I don't know that they would have done it right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a piece of, like, that's, that to me, like, there's so much more that we should focus on. That cultural competency will come from being exposed to other cultures. And that schools are not in any way, shape, or form, if we're talking about the things that are wrong,
mm-hmm.
are not at all equipped to give that kind of broad exposure to
right.
cultures. Like, there are some schools that are magnet schools or charters or some public schools that take their kids all over the world. And
mm-hmm.
I think that that's a really wonderful idea. But if that's not what we're doing for everybody, then
yeah,
so let's move on to another conversation.
Right.
I guess...
By the way, done with my coffee.
Oh, so
okay.
we can wrap things
so
up.
So we can wrap
time.
Things up.
Oh, here. But
what were we going
to
say?
Just to... Because for me, I feel like I come from... I'm coming from a similar situation,
mm-hmm.
but like in retrospect, I wish someone had taught me that.
What would you have? What? How? Is my guess.
Well, I guess from my own personal experience, I was Brownsville, Brooklyn, New York, not the most affluent of places, and I was in public school at the time, kind of miserable there, didn't really do very well. Got lucky, got a scholarship, went to this very affluent boarding school in Simsbury, Connecticut, for high school, and. It was
wait, where in Connecticut?
Simsbury.
Okay.
Simsbury. Connecticut. And it was a culture shock. And I really, really wish that before, you know, setting me off to this place to live there for 7 days, or, you know, not even 7 days a week, but like 3 months, 3 to 9 months out of the year, you know, someone had told me, you know, okay, this is random questions white girls will ask you, you know? Or,
the world is bigger than your backyard.
Yeah, and so just like I felt like I struggled so much with just you know, interacting with people who were my age, who were from a completely different social
right.
stratus, you know, and it was really, really frustrating. And I think a lot of the pains that I've gone through now, and even looking back at my experience now, I feel like I've othered my community because there I was. Consistently told, okay, well, you have to kind of forget.
You've othered which community?
My own community, like where I'm
Brooklyn.
from Brownsville.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've kind of, being in Simsbury, Connecticut, I felt like, well, this is what people aspire to. This is what people want to be.
Interesting.
And
that
so
really
I have to leave that behind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't talk that way. I can't talk the way I talked with my mom. I can't, you know, I've shunned that part of myself. And only now, as I've gotten older and, you know, gone through and realized the kind of, the language of that type of behavior,
mm-hmm.
Can I say, okay, I shouldn't have done that, and I wish somebody had told me, you know, you can be in this affluent place and get along and do well academically without being like, that crap neighborhood where I'm from is no longer relevant
mm.
to me or good for me.
And listening to that, I think, I just wish the people in Simsbury had been taught how to talk to people in Brooklyn more than I worry about Brooklyn people teaching.
Right.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Go the other
yeah.
way. Like, here's
yeah.
how you talk to people whose skin is maybe darker than yours.
But again, and like, I think that's fair.
Like, don't ask them these questions.
I also feel like that's unrealistic. Like, I think that's true and that should happen, but at the same time, we're all being primed to get along in a dominant culture.
Right. And I think that's the danger of when we say cultural competency.
Right.
We don't really
mean
training all cultures.
Rather than training
yeah,
we're
clearly not.
We want
yeah.
you to get you. We want you to be competent in upper middle class
so
white
you don't
culture.
Piss off the white people.
Yeah, exactly.
Just so you don't embarrass yourself.
Yeah.
And that
sound right.
That's some dangerous stuff.
Oh, it's terrible
to get into.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was. I still struggle with like. Upper class or upper middle class, like they're like
mm-hmm.
moving into Florida. There's some rich people in Florida.
One or two.
Yeah. Growing up in a rural place,
yeah.
not a lot.
Right.
Right. And so there's a whole different functioning there. So I didn't even have to think race. I just had to think about socioeconomic.
Social stuff.
And it was just like, okay, but why can't you just talk like normal people talk? You know, like, there was like, why do I have to use so many words to say an idea?
There's too many words in the
thing. And there really was. Yeah.
Like, wow, we make a lot of small talk before we actually talk about what we want to talk about. And that, like,
and then we make podcasts about it.
Yeah. Yeah. We try to be as succinct as possible. It's really interesting.
Yeah. That is really fascinating.
And I'm trying to think about, because then you're saying, like, I wish somebody had told me, here's how you interact in this.
Not even, like, the interaction. Just be like, there's nothing wrong with your culture.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know.
So it's really just cultural acceptance, not
exactly.
necessarily competence.
Or just being aware that there are differences, mm-hmm. and that one is not better.
Uh-huh.
You know, so kind of what, to what Scott was saying, which is sort of like, there are differences. There are people who think very differently than you. There are people who make more money than you. There are people who own horses. Who you will not be sleeping next to for 9 months, but
not the horses.
You're sleeping next to the owners.
Okay,
but you know it was, and I felt like because no one was there to say these cultures are equal, and because I had to be taken out of my community to be given this better education,
right.
you know, I felt like that it changed the way that I saw myself as a Black person. It changed myself. The way I saw myself as a Black person in my home neighborhood,
uh-huh.
and then a Black person there, and then later a Black person at Harvard, you know?
Right.
And so my whole, because everything, can, like I said, I feel like you can't teach up, but you have to teach across, and cultural competency across.
All. And that becomes a huge undertaking because across covers so much land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like physical and metaphoric.
Right.
So much.
Which is why I feel like you, it's like teaching flexibility or teaching open-mindedness.
Right.
To say, okay, you're not going to get what white people do. White people are going to say stupid shit to you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know.
No, it's okay. Scott dropped the F-bomb last show.
I did, although I've been super good about it this time because we submitted the podcast to iTunes as clean, and then they took the label off.
They accepted it.
Sorry.
They did accept it, but they took the label clean off of the podcast.
Does it say explicit?
No, it just doesn't say clean.
I'm okay with that.
It's fine. Can't keep my mouth shut.
But you know, I feel like you just have to. You need to teach people flexibility and open-mindedness, and I feel like that more than anything needs to be at the heart of cultural competency.
Right.
Because you can't teach someone how.
Well, that has to be at the heart of learning.
True.
Right. Because you can't teach them everything about anything.
True.
Right.
Very true.
And so, like, and so then it gets back to, see what I'm doing? then it gets back to, are we looking for learning in ways that would encourage people to be flexible in their learning, right? Are we looking for people to be creative in how we, and I don't want to say assessing, but when we look at a classroom, when we look at a school, when we look at any kind of learning relationship, are the ways that we value the way we look for learning that encourage that flexibility? And if there are, find that policy, write it, make it everywhere.
Right.
That's your job.
Okay. You're EPM too. What are you doing?
He's doing podcasts.
This is my policy.
With me. I want to wrap up with speaking to that with an author of young adult fiction named John Green, who speaks particularly to this issue of kind of flexibility and assessment, what we'll call assessment. He calls it testing. John Green, in addition to being a prize-winning author of fiction, is also a YouTube vlogger with the Vlog Brothers, and also has just recently started a video series called Crash Course. It's a series of educational videos. And he makes a lot of jokes in his content. And he has this to say about testing. And I think it's really interesting. And it's the thing that I learned this week.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. Nicely done.
It's the thing that I learned this week.
So we should get ours ready then?
Yeah, get ready, because I'm going to, and I'll talk
slow. It's just this week. Just this week.
Okay. He impersonates a student and says, is this going to be on the test? And then as the teacher, he answers, yeah, about the test. The test will measure whether or not you are an informed, engaged, and productive citizen of the world. And it will take place in schools and bars and hospitals and dorm rooms and in places of worship. You'll be tested on first dates, in job interviews, while watching football, and while scrolling through your Twitter feed. The test will judge your ability to think about things other than celebrity marriages, whether you'll be easily persuaded by empty political rhetoric, and whether you'll be able to place your life and your community in a broader context. The test will last your entire life, and it will be comprised of the millions of decisions that, when taken together, make your life yours. And everything, everything will be on it. I think that speaks, that's the end of the quote. I think that speaks very, I think it speaks eloquently to what, as educators, those of us who are passionate about education, what we are trying to do. I don't think it's about specifically math or specifically science or specifically a standardized testing subject. And I hope with the policymakers in the room that we can try to be conscious of that. When we make policy about education, we're not making it about a number on a test. We're making it about educating individuals who will be able to make informed and productive decisions for themselves. I really think that's what education is about. As a teacher, it's what I've always thought, and I think that sums it up rather well. So that's what I learned this week.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nisha?
I really like that quote. It sounds like a graduation speech.
It does sound like
we should call him.
Thank you, class of 2012.
I think I am going to call him. See if I'll be like, I go to Harvard. Can you talk to me?
All you got
to
do is drop the H-bomb. Yeah. They won't get paid, though. You have to tell them.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody will give you money. Yeah. Just know that up front.
What did I learn this week? I had it in my head and it left.
We sometimes have that effect on people.
We make a lot of people forget what they were going to say.
I learned that Chicago is one of the top places to live for single women. Top five.
So applicable to life.
I had something way more like intellectual than that, but I'll wrap up with that one.
That's outstanding.
All right, I dig that.
I'm looking for the future.
No, that's nice. You've created a nice counterbalance to Scott's like really. Like,
wait, no.
That's good. I love it.
Now I really have to make up for that.
No. You're done now.
That was outstanding.
Sorry.
I picked up this book called Millennial Momentum this week, not for class. Which a friend of mine had a lot of trouble. Like, what class are you reading that for? Not. Well, why are you reading it?
Why are you reading it? She's like, well, no. What class? For fun. Though. What's fun?
So they talk about the different waves of generations, and they kind of they go in 40-year increments, and that the millennials are. So there are four kinds of generations in these waves, and so it's the idealist, the reactive, the civic, and the adaptive, and that the millennial generation is the is a civic generation, and so it's an interesting thing, and it's really shaped how I've listened to conversations throughout the week, in kind of this idea of most of the people who are here in the ed school and going through classes are millennials, because it's 1982 to 2004, I want to say. Is the generation.
I said 8-year-olds, but okay.
Well, yeah, exactly, very young. but the thinking is kind of the civic and it's the idea of not blow up the system as kind of, or be disenfranchised of like Gen Xers before the millennials. But the idea of, no, we've got these serious problems, let's really overhaul what we're doing. And it's a lot of what formed the conversation today. And so it's really got me thinking, I wonder how much of this is just when we were born, versus who we actually are, or some interaction of both of those ideas. So that's been really interesting. That's the thing I learned. First, just that there were the four kind of boom, 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 boom. And then, oh, this is the kind of generation we're in right now. So it's really been interesting. That said, Anisha, thank you very much for sitting down and having a cup of coffee with us today.
Thank you guys for inviting me. Of course. Had a good time.
Yeah. You wasted another cup of coffee listening to Learning Grounds.
This has been episode 2. Today's date was February 10th of 2012.
He's kind of sure about that.
I had to look.
And so thank you very much for joining us. Anisha, thank you again. And peace out, yo.
Go!
Thank you for listening to Learning Grounds with Scott and Zach. Our intro music comes from New Dance Boys Mission. It's called Intro, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Learning Grounds is also under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. Say it three times fast. And thanks for listening.